Hi there, I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev, and what you're about to hear is an episode from the new VoxDev podcast, Ideas in Development. We're excited to launch this second podcast that will feature a series of conversations on growth, AI, cities, and a whole lot more. But do not worry, Tim is going nowhere, and VoxDev Talks will continue as normal. Costa Rica's most valuable export might surprise you. As of 2023, medical devices accounted for 30% of Costa Rica's export value, outweighing the value of bananas, coffee, and some of the other more stereotypically Costa Rican exports you might have had in mind. And medical devices are just the latest in a long line of export success stories that have seen Costa Rica transformed by investment from large multinational companies. I'm Oliver Hanney, and this is Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research.
And I'm Karthik Akhileshwaran, co-founder of Growth Teams. And in this mini-series, we're learning about sector success stories from Latin America, Africa, and Asia, directly from the policymakers who helped to make them happen. Today, we'll ask how Costa Rica, a small country of around 5 million people, became an attractive hub that now hosts operations for over 1,000 multinationals. To take us through this economic history, we're joined by Andres Valenciano Yamuni, who played his own role on Costa Rica's FDI journey during his time as Minister of Foreign Trade. Andres, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Thank you, Oliver and Kantik, for the invite. Pleasure to be here.
Andres, before getting into your time as minister, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your route into politics.
Thank you. Well, I would say mine was not a traditional path. I'm an engineer, my background, but then I worked in development, broadly defined. So I worked with NGOs, international organizations, mostly in Latin America and in Costa Rica, in where I worked closely with government, but not in government. But then after many years of doing that type of work, working on education, poverty reduction, supporting entrepreneurs, things like that, we had elections in 2018 in which it was very particular elections for Costa Rica because the government that the party that won was actually a coalition. It was so-called a government of national unity. So when that coalition of different political parties and the private sector arrived in office, they decided to bring people who were not only politicians by career, let's say, but also people who had more of a technical or practitioner background like myself. So it just happened that I was actually living in Thailand in that moment when I got a phone call to join this coalition when the government was already elected. So I obviously had getting a call from the president of your country to work on the issues that in my case, I've been working for so many years. Now I got the chance to actually do it within government. And as part of this broader coalition was a fascinating moment, not only for the country, obviously, but for myself on a personal and professional level. So I packed my suitcase and returned home, and I served in that government for those 4 years. But again, it was not the typical way of getting into a cabinet level position, but having worked closely with different governments, being obviously well aware of the needs of my country and having worked on these issues in the region allowed me to, I would say, make a rather smooth transition into politics.
And as the Minister of Foreign Trade, what was your remit? What were the kind of main responsibilities that you had?
In Costa Rica, I know this is, every country has its own institutional design, but we have both a Minister of Foreign Affairs, who's more on the diplomacy side, and we have the Ministry of Foreign Trade. And in Costa Rica, the Ministry of Foreign Trade is in charge, first, of promoting exports, of attracting investment, of all the trade facilitation and trade negotiations, meaning for a small country, as you just described it, 5 million people, 5.5 million people, we are a very open economy. So for a minister of foreign trade, it's a fascinating role because we have right now around 17, 18 free trade agreements that basically connects Costa Rica with 75% of the world economy. So trade negotiations, and it's a big part of our role. I also mentioned bringing FDI, but also promoting new exports, then representing Costa Rica on forums like the WTO. And by particular design, when I was a minister, we were finishing the process of accession towards the OECD. And when it was started, which it was a long process, it took almost 8 years, it was decided that the Minister of Foreign Trade would have the, not only would be the contact person for the OECD, it would actually lead this process. So when I was in office, that was also one of the important roles that I had, because as you can imagine, becoming part of the OECD requires to not only pass regulations that fall within the Minister of Foreign Trade, but under other ministries, but also requires to passing legislation. So it meant a lot of negotiations with Congress. So it had that particular flavor, I would say, of being Minister of Foreign Trade at that moment. And then when we successfully became part of the OECD, we then had to design a strategy of how we were going to leverage being part of this, member club to be able to continue improving our standards and regulations to present ourselves to the world as a world-leading country on many aspects related to policy and development.
So, Andres, some of our listeners might not be aware of Costa Rica's long history of attracting foreign investment. Ever since Intel's investment in Costa Rica almost 30 years ago, the country has been a leader in FDI relative to the size of its economy. Could you give us a brief overview of Costa Rica's history of investment attraction from 1996 until you became minister in 2020?
So Costa Rica's story, it's an interesting one because I think it can serve as an example of how a small country can actually become, you know, very interconnected with the global economy and become a global leader in many aspects. So being very brief, if we go back to the 1980s, Costa Rica, as well as many other Latin American countries, had a big crisis, which led to this lost decade. And this was a big macroeconomic fiscal crisis that eventually made us reassess how our approach towards being a small open economy had to be, right? So starting in the early 90s, there was a big shift towards this export-led growth model. And that meant, first and foremost, obviously signal that to the world. But internally, and one of the big strategic decisions was on institutional design. And that was critical because if you're a small country that wants to open yourself to the world, you better have the organizations with the capability of not only negotiating with other countries, like I mentioned on the free trade agreement side, but also to be able to coordinate with the private sector. And that has been absolutely fundamental since the 1990s of that close coordination with the private sector that has led us to become this global leader on FDI attraction and export diversification. But in the 1990s, as part of that institutional design, the Ministry of Foreign Trade was there, and it was there. We also had our investment promotion agency, CINDE, and we created PROCOMER, which is the export promotion agency. So between these three organizations, there was a close coordination on setting what would become one of the most stable policies in the country. So since the early 1990s up until now, we've had four different political parties in office, and the idea of being an export-led growth model has always been there. And that has been actually one of the key aspects of why multinationals choose to invest in Costa Rica. But then going back to the 1990s, as part of this decision, a country made a big bet on trying to bring Intel to the country. because bringing a company like Intel back in the 1990s would not only send a signal to the rest of the world that Costa Rica had the conditions for one of the world's most advanced semiconductor companies in the world to operate in, but it would also help us understand the demands of these type of companies. And back in the 1990s, when this decision was made and we ended up, let's say, part of the short list of countries where Intel was deciding where to invest, it was interesting because Costa Rica didn't really make any specific firm, you know, concessions to Intel. Most of the things that Intel mentioned that they require to operate in the country were things related to everything from connectivity to infrastructure, to customs, to the airports, those type of things, red tape, obviously fiscal incentives. And I can talk a little bit more about the free trade zone because that has been a key aspect of this decision making towards an export and an investment-led growth model. But those concessions actually allowed us to not only bring Intel, but bring up many other advanced manufacturing companies. And that's why if you see the history of the 1990s till today, you'll see that, yes, it was semiconductors with Intel being like this big jump. But then, as you pointed out, now the main good that we export is actually medical devices. And medical devices, semiconductors, they are both advanced manufacturing, they require clean rooms, high levels of quality and standards, they require specialized skills. Those things that we had already been offering to the semiconductor sector, we could then offer to the medical devices. And most recently, actually the biggest export is knowledge intensive services that Costa Rica has. And that's also a fascinating transition. More recently, after semiconductors, medical devices, now knowledge intensive services, because you've seen a couple of trends and with this I'll wrap up, which is the servicification of manufacturing, meaning we already had advanced manufacturing companies in operating in the country. They realized it was relatively easy because of, the level of levels of English speaking population in the country, the skill sets that we had. We already had connectivity. We already had all these, let's say, productivity factors in country that then allowed us to tell companies, well, why can you bring, let's say, your back office, your financial services, your human resources services, and other companies from tech started seeing, well, we can operate our design, communications, consulting, finance, logistics, and now it is extremely diversified, and it has become overpassing tourism, which was the biggest services export by a lot. Now it's actually like I mentioned, knowledge intensive services the biggest export. So it's been a transition between opening the model for export led growth, creating the institutional capabilities on delivering on that, and then working very closely with the companies on those sectors to understand their needs and deliver for semiconductors, medical devices, which are advanced manufacturing, and now knowledge-intensive services. So that's in a whirlwind what Costa Rica was able to achieve, and now it's the number one exporter of knowledge-intensive services per capita of all Latin America. We export highest levels amongst the OECD as well, member countries. We continue to export, as you mentioned, bananas and pineapples. We are the number one exporter of pineapples around the world, number two of bananas, things like that. But they pale in comparison to these other sectors that overpass them.
So that was an amazing whistle-stop tour there of 30-ish years of Costa Rican history. My next question was about kind of what's the point of all of this work that Costa Rica has been doing to attract the multinationals? What exactly does Costa Rica get out of this?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question and one that when I was in office, we discussed a lot, like what do we want to get out of it? And there are many countries, for example, that they measure the success of FDI attraction in terms of the amount of dollars that they bring into, foreign currency that they bring into a country. And that's great. That's important for many countries. But the way that we measure success is way more than that. We want to make sure that the companies that we attract, first and foremost, are sectors that are strategic to the country. And this is more than just me, you know, saying it on this podcast. We have developed ways of filtering and making sure, for example, that if you're a foreign investor and you want to apply for the free trade zone regime, meaning you're going to get some fiscal incentives and some type of benefits, well, the way that you apply to become part of the free trade zone regime actually has to pass an evaluation. And we have evolved the free trade zone regime to adapt to the different sectors and strategic decisions that are, as a country, we've done. And I'll give you one example. When I was in government, we realized that services, like I mentioned, was becoming a bigger part of our the investment coming into the country. So we decided to create an index to evaluate if a company from the services sector was looking, let's say, for the fiscal incentive, but not giving the country much more than that. So we created this index that actually evaluates a company when it applies for the free trade zone regime. And it evaluates it first. Is it on a strategic sector? How many jobs is this company going to create? What type of jobs, like the salaries of these jobs? What is the potential for this company to have linkages? And this type of index, which was homegrown, it was created by the people, like I mentioned, of the Export Promotion Agency, would allow us to filter companies, as you know, that are looking, let's say, either for a tax haven, which are basically, they say that they operate in a country, but maybe their headcount is one or two people, two individuals there. This would allow us to measure, and not only on an initial, let's say, acceptance to the free trade zone regime, but actually it allows us to measure that as time passes. So we want to make sure that the companies that are in country are creating those jobs, are compliant, are in compliance with our social security, and they're doing their work in that end, that they're also contributing to the development of that strategic sector. So it's way more than just attracting dollars. Then on the manufacturing side, the Central Bank of Costa Rica, in partnership with, like I mentioned, the Investment Promotion Agency and the Export Promotion Agency, have historically done a lot of evaluations to measure what is the impact of all of this. And for example, every year they measure for every dollar that you provide them as a tax incentive, how many dollars does the country receive? And that measure is always 1 to 2. So for every dollar that we give, the country receives $2. That's around the measure that every year we see on the data. Also, we have asked the question, like, are we able to create linkages between the FDI, the multinationals that come to the country, with the rest of the economy? And the answer is yes. And this has also been part of a very proactive strategy on our behalf. We've created programs to try to solve this asymmetry of information that multinationals may have about what type of local suppliers are there in country. Same with the local suppliers. They might not know that there's actually potential buyers from the multinational corporations, and they need what type of products, what type of services, in what quality, with what type of certifications, in what quantities. Like, we help bridge those two with programs that is actually called linkages. Like, we proactively create that. And what we have seen is, and this is again, very rigorous evaluation done by economists at the central bank. And these are, some articles have been published in journals around the world that demonstrate that the linkages actually help, and the spillovers actually impact the local companies in terms of the wages that they pay, the productivity that they have, the growth that they have as companies. So all that to say that when a country is choosing its strategy for FDI, also has to consider those type of things. And with this, I'll wrap up. When you have sectors like medical devices, those are some of the hardest and highest levels of quality in terms of procurement, in terms of suppliers that there is out there. So as you can imagine, that is a very hard case to make for local organizations to become suppliers of them. That's why, but at the same time, they provide knowledge spillovers and they help bring technology, things like that. But why do I mention that? It's because when I was in government, and we haven't really mentioned this issue, was we made a big bet also on creating and, let's say, relaunching agriculture as one of those strategic sectors. Why agriculture? Because it could balance this very knowledge-intensive services and advanced manufacturing that might be amazing for the individuals who are able to participate in those companies. But there is a whole other sector of the economy in rural areas, coastal areas, where agriculture continues to be the driver, the engine of growth and job creation. So we know that if we really wanted to have a two-pronged strategy of very knowledge intensive, but let's say it might not be creating jobs where we want it, we could also launch agriculture and provide more technology and obviously technical assistance and funding. So agriculture could also become one of those strategic sectors that would help us with this strategy that I mentioned of FDI not only being an issue about dollars, let's say, but also about job creation and improving, let's say, national development as a whole.
It's super interesting to hear kind of how in detail you go on the impact side of things. I guess to summarize kind of what you've just said then, I think it's clear that Costa Rica has benefited a lot from FDI, but that wasn't a natural occurrence, and it involved a lot of hard work on your end to kind of make sure that the benefits materialized. And you even kind of steered some of that by picking certain sectors to promote, depending on where those jobs might end up.
Reflecting on all these great examples that you've shared, if you could pick out some of the key factors in attracting investment, what would they be? You know, in other words, what does it take to attract multinationals, especially given the intense competition between countries for the same footloose FDI?
First, I would caution against, as they call it, like a laundry list approach to it. Meaning that, if you get your, let's say, fiscal stability, if you get the right macroeconomic conditions, if you have, high levels of schooling, you do this laundry list approach and then FDI doesn't come in. That has been a repeated mistake of the past, I would say, by other countries. I think it requires more of a, in a way, it's also like a learning by doing approach. Yes, there are basic underlying factors that are required. And if you look at, do a literature review about this question, you'll find that they'll tell you, yes, you need political stability. Obviously, if a company is willing to make an investment, a long-term investment that would require a lot of capital mobilization and a big bet, it's making it under the assumption that the rules of the game will stay for the long run, right? That's one. Then there are, broadly defined other conditions, some sort of, economic stability, not much volatility. You will need some sort of, qualified human capital in the country, some sort of infrastructure and connectivity. Like those are like broadly defined, but I don't think that's useful, let's say, to the level that a policymaker requires. So I think beyond understanding those, broad conditions that, yes, they are necessary, I think it requires more of this collaboration with the private sector that I mentioned, and then the organizational or institutional capacity to deliver on them. And I underline that because I think that's a very, very big aspect of it. So I'll give you some examples. So when you sit down with companies to understand, what are their needs, they'll tell you, yes, I mean, obviously the macroeconomic stability, the rule of law, all the basic things. But if you don't have the qualified people that I need for my line of work, I won't be able to invest. And then you say, well, but we have a lot of accountants, let's say, Why can't you bring more of those back office services of accounting? You know, a very basic thing, I would say. They'll tell you, well, maybe what type of accounting training are you providing? It's like, well, these are all accountants graduated from the best universities in the country. And they'll say, that's perfect. But actually, are they bilingual? That's one. But then, are they actually being trained on accounting rules and regulations that are used in the US, which is different from what they're used in Costa Rica? You know, it's those basic things that once you start on this learning by doing approach in partnership with companies, and you need the companies that are really understanding not only their needs as an individual firm, but they're also understanding how they can help the ecosystem develop. And that's also finding the right partners in the right sectors, because otherwise, you know, you end up having companies that are only interested in their square meter. They're usually, you know, incumbents or who are there, who are already established, and they don't allow you to think about the potentials that a country might have. So I think a lot of what we've done is we have set up offices all around the world for the export promotion agency and the investment promotion agency to map not only the companies, but the individuals within those companies who are operating literally all around the world, to make sure we understand what role can that company could eventually play in Costa Rica. And then the exercise is not about the laundry list, but more about understanding those specific needs, whether it's about talent, whether it's about like, oh, if let's say, I'll give you another example that might not be too obvious, but if you're a multinational and you're planning on moving a lot of your staff to another country, and even very high level staff might be vice presidents, VPs for a whole region. These vice presidents who are making the decisions, they will also ask the question, well, what's the airport connectivity? How many flights do I have from that country to be able to fly to headquarters? I'm going to move in there with my family. So where do I put my kids to school? Is there a hospital infrastructure around there? You know, those things that might not be obvious, but there are at the end, obviously, like I mentioned, those other factors that I started the conversation with play a big role, but these other small ones do make a difference. Then more and more companies, especially multinational companies, have indicators, KPIs that are related, let's say, to water use or renewable energy. And if you're a country like Costa Rica, where 99.5% of your electricity comes from renewable energy, then you can use it as a selling point. But also that has to do with understanding if these are the type of companies that are interested in those factors as competitive ones. So I mentioned the free trade zone regime. We've developed in a way that makes sure that we're able to provide the conditions that makes it attractive from, let's say, a tax or fiscal perspective. But these other issues, like, and I'll mention two additional things. One, I've been talking about talent. I think talent will continue to be a driving decision, a driving factor for the decision-making process for sure. But then the other thing that has been a proven success, and not every country has it like this, is how do we set up the industrial parks, meaning where the company was going to be located. The way that it works in Costa Rica is that those parks, those industrial parks, are actually privately operated. So it creates a competition among parks to deliver added value beyond saying, well, I'm going to help you build, you know, the infrastructure where you're going to operate. Then, because we have multiple world-class industrial parks, they started competing amongst each other for that investment. So now they offer a lot of added value to, let's say, a company that is making a decision, well, I'm going to invest in Costa Rica. That's the whole of country approach. But then once in Costa Rica, we create the conditions for them to see what this industrial park offers. And to make it, you know, clear, I'll give an example. Nowadays, companies say, well, you know what? We've been building, you know, clean rooms. We know that you need redundancy in your electricity because you can never have a you can never be out of power. But we're also going to offer transportation for your employees, so you don't have to worry about that. We're going to make sure that there's, you know, private bus routes to bring people to your company. We're also going to provide in-house, meaning within the park. They created partnerships with, you know, the Ministry of Education, the National Institute of Learning, which is technical education, or even developing programs at the graduate level with universities, for example, on management for medical devices sectors. And those programs are offered within the industrial park, meaning it's relatively easy for individuals to, you know, work in those organizations, in those companies, and then have access to continuous education. They have access to transportation. They have access to green areas and sports facilities. So all these are value-added initiatives that are privately done that create, you know, a competition environment that allowed us to raise the bar. So when a company says, I'm not only investing in Costa Rica, which offers all these things or variables that I mentioned, I also have a smooth landing site in an industrial park where there's a lot of other companies who have been already located there, but then they offer me all these services as an added value for investing in this park versus the other. So that, again, is an example of public-private coordination that has been a discovery process of understanding the needs of the companies, whether it's transportation or continuous learning for their employees. Because a lot of companies, when they do this scouting process, one of the questions that they ask is, how long will it take me to have my company run fully by locals and not bring people from the outside? So by developing this, you know, I mentioned technical education, but also at the high school level and then at the graduate level, programs that are tailored for this type of companies, it makes it very easy for multinationals to say, well, I'm going to quickly be able to have the local talent be running these companies. And that also, it's a cost reduction and it's also a risk reduction. So it makes absolute sense for them. So it's a lot of variables. Again, not the laundry list approach, more of a process of discovering this with public-private coordination. And then obviously that means from the government side, you have the organizational capacity to do so.
And you've already touched on sort of many aspects of the how already. I'd be curious to know, you know, who specifically are the key players involved in this process, both in the government and the private sector, and what specifically do they do? Beyond passing legislation, you mentioned public-private collaboration. You know, perhaps there's other things that they're doing along the way that facilitate, you know, the investment and so on.
I'll give you two examples. One is back, and I think the case of Intel illustrates the way that Costa Rica decided to move forward with this. When Intel was were in that process in the 90s. The idea was that the Ministry of Foreign Trade would lead the coordination among all the rest of the governmental ministries and institutions that needed to be part of this. And that was science and technology, finance, education, infrastructure. And this was a direct mandate by the president. So I think that, and that helped coordinate what was needed to for the country to deliver. And then having, you know, the counterparts in this case, a company like Intel up to the very senior level, highest senior levels actually of the organization was absolutely critical. Then moving forward, I mentioned institutional design and I'll go back to it. So when the Export Promotion Agency was created in the mid 90s, 1996, it has a very clear mandate of public-private coordination. And that institutional design has made all the difference. So for example, the board of the Export Promotion Agency actually has a majority of representatives from the private sector, but the president of that board is the Minister of Foreign Trade. So I was the president of that board, but having a majority of people from the private sector. Why is that critical? Because that allows the private sector to be able to keep, you know, have a continuity beyond the electoral processes. You know, they can provide the continuity to some of the projects and processes because they can vote on it. They can, you know, represent the needs of the private sector at the board level. But then you have a president who's the representative from the executive branch that allows to the organization to make a link with the national priorities and the voices of the private sector. Now, that allows for the coordination within this export promotion agency, which is in charge of the free trade zone regime, of export creation, of all the trade facilitation, many things that I've mentioned before. But moving forward, the key thing that we've done is we've created in different instances almost like a cluster approach to collaboration. And this cluster approach, which there's a lot of theory and a lot of literature around them, one of the key aspects that I would mention is that when you're selecting the people that get to participate, to sit on the table between the private and the public, what usually happens is that you end up creating this, you know, committees or, you know, or meetings where you end up not participating as a minister, but you end up sending someone that represents the Ministry of Foreign Trade or the Export Promotion Agency. And then from the private counterparts, they realize that the minister or someone high level in the administration is not there. So they end up sending someone with no decision-making power. So they become useless, those many spaces. So the lesson there is that when you're going to have, let's say, a cluster approach or a public-private collaboration, you want to make sure that the people who get to sit on the table are people that not only have decision-making power, but that they also go beyond their firm in terms of the understanding of the benefit of developing a whole ecosystem, a whole sector approach. And again, that requires a lot of due diligence to making sure that, for example, when we created a medical devices cluster, we worked with people who were from multinationals, but they had already done this type of sectorial approaches in other parts of the world. So they already understood what it takes to have this public-private coordination, to carry out not only the regulations, like the regulatory changes, the policy changes to create the enabling conditions for the private sector to continue investing. And at the same time, and I'll give an example, the private sector sometimes doesn't realize how challenging it is for the perspective of the government to carry out policies that respond to their needs because private sector sometimes don't understand their own needs. And this is the example I want to give. I always talk about this is if you gather, and we've done this in the past, I did it in the past, but this is very common. When you gather a group of companies from a similar sector, I'll give the example of cybersecurity, and they say that they're willing to hire, and you have 10 different companies, and each company says, I'm willing to hire 200 cybersecurity technicians. And the other company says, I'm going to hire 300 cybersecurity technicians. And the other one says 1,000 and 500. And then you add that up and you say, well, these are thousands of jobs they're going to create. But then you ask them one by one, what does your cybersecurity technician actually do? And in many cases, they'll give you different answers. All that to say, like moving away from job descriptions towards competency-based or skills-based allows not only to companies to realize that, oh, that's why in many cases you have a skills mismatch. You say, well, we're graduating thousands of cybersecurity experts. And then they'll say, yes, but actually what I need is an expert in threats or risks. And I need more that has a profile of a coder. Or, you know, there's dozens of different profiles for cybersecurity technicians. So having that space in which you can have an honest, candid conversation with the private sector to make them realize that, oh, you are also talking about different things within your own sector. on skills development allows us to develop the type of programs that, let's say, will bring the level of know-how, of skills, to a point which it's useful for every company. And then if each company will take it from then and develop the specificity that they need for the profiles they're hiring. But we wouldn't be able to fix that, let's say, information asymmetry or that skills mismatch if we didn't have the right people in the room who understood exactly what were the needs that they have as companies, but also what does it take to build an ecosystem around it. And again, that was also a matter of having the due diligence to make sure who is on the table and who is participating in those conversations, and the private sector actors are seen as collaborating to build the ecosystem.
It seems like Costa Rica has developed a ton of experience. I guess one of the common themes of your answers has been this concept of learning by doing and kind of figuring things out as you go along and getting better at them over time. I guess it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on whether kind of Costa Rica's approach and experience is something you feel can be replicated in other countries, and whether that would be kind of a copy and paste of what you've done, or kind of starting out with the same mindset and ending up somewhere new.
I think, again, I mentioned the limits of this laundry list approach, right, to answer this question. So I think it's more about the process. How, for example, if I'm another country, I would ask myself, okay, do I have a clear sense of what type of strategic sectors are the ones that I want to build upon? And FDI can play a role in developing those sectors, right? Then I would ask, do I have the organizational capability to do that? Do I have the possibility of coordinating among ministries and industries to be able to have this feedback, quick feedback by the private sector to understand their needs? So it's more about asking the right questions, I think. But I think the interesting case of Costa Rica is like, it's like it can be done by even by a small country. It can be done in a relatively short amount of time. But I would say that I would be hesitant of telling people exactly what, you know, each country should do and how should they approach it. Again, it's not like the country was created in the 1990s. There was a lot of things that happened before that also are enabling conditions. I mean, Costa Rica abolished its army in 1949, creating the longest standing democracy in Latin America. So a lot of political stability. We had already invested a lot in education. And even if this wasn't like specific engineers or technicians for these industries, there was, let's say, a strong foundation which could be built upon. Costa Rica had already sent signals of how it wanted to integrate itself or be part of the global economy, right? So there were a lot of things that happened before that I think as a policymaker, when you arrive in office, you're not arriving on a vacuum. So understanding like what are those building blocks that you have to work upon, and then asking yourself the right questions around like, what type of sectors do you think the country has the capability of developing, creating? Is it, what is the role of FDI in all of that? And then, obviously, that has to do a lot with the capacity to coordinate with other ministries, because all the structural transformations that our countries need, developing countries need, won't come from a single institution. Right. By definition, being structural, they require a lot of collaboration between the finance and the infrastructure and education and agriculture. And so do you have the mechanisms to be able to coordinate to make sure that FDI becomes one tool for development, not the end? And that I would have to say, being self-critical, Costa Rica is now on a point where, and it's been in that point for a while, in a similar situation, let's say, as Malaysia, in the sense that a lot of this has been FDI driven. But the question is now, can we actually develop our own companies that become the multinationals of the world. And yes, we have a couple of examples of them. One, for example, within the medical devices sector, a global leader on breast implants and surgical procedures is Costa Rican. And it was, you know, led by Costa Ricans for Costa Ricans. It developed around that ecosystem that I mentioned. But again, it's one example. How do you create then the other exporters that are local grown, that are able to become suppliers, that are able to become buyers, that are able to become the next multinationals of this world? That is a big challenge that we have moving forward. I think you can't have this over-reliance of FDI, as we all seen, given the geopolitical tensions recently. But I think the next step is how to continue. And that is something that the country is working a lot on. It's putting a lot of resources, a lot of assistance, funding on developing this new, let's say, set of exporters. But again, that's specific to Costa Rica. In other countries, they might say, well, we're on a stage where first we need to be able to bring some new investment because that would allow us to learn from those companies and do everything that I mentioned around the spillovers and the linkages, and that helps create more dynamism within the local economy. So yes, there are lessons that can be learned, but I would be hesitant of having this laundry list approach and more of a, you know, question asking and be in the context that provides you the answers to those questions around the strategic sectors, the capability to deliver upon them, the coordination mechanisms, and really understanding the private sector needs to be able to deliver upon them.
To wrap up, based on all these experiences that you've shared and your own time as minister, what do you think is under-researched by academics, but practitioners like you understand deeply and think could use more attention from researchers?
That's a great question. So when I was in government, we, like I mentioned, a lot of research that was done by the central bank and by our own organizations, and obviously research by other international organizations help understand global dynamics and trends. And those are useful because they provide the context of where you operate in, right? But I think one of the biggest areas, and I would love to see more of academics trying to understand it, is this execution gap. In the sense that if you talk to many policymakers around the world from developing countries, I mean, yes, we can continue generating new evidence of what works and what doesn't. That's important. But in many cases, I wouldn't say that's the binding constraint. I think if you go around the world asking policymakers, they have an idea of what needs to be done. The big challenge is, do you have, again, the organizational capability to deliver on those? And this goes down to something very basic, is that you may have this very well thought out, evidence-based plan on what needs to be done on education or what needs to be done to reduce informality or increase productivity or, you know, or deliver on infrastructure. But then you have to, at some point, that plan, that all the evidence that gets translated into a plan, into a program, into a project, gets handed off into an institution or an organization or a ministry. And that organization is in charge of executing it. And then why is it that we're not able to execute it? Has to do with, well, obviously you first need, you know, some sort of political consensus around it. Like, this needs to happen, and you have to have a coalition of political actors that are willing to say, yes, we're going to do this. But then is the organizational capability to deliver on that? And that, I would say, would be fascinating to understand more. Like, what is needed to create those conditions on organizations? Is it, again, I draw from my own experience, because that example of the Export Promotion Agency, which has this board that was created like that. But I forgot to mention that another critical success factor is that when it was created, the Export Promotion Agency, actually it has a different, let's say, regime than the civil service in Costa Rica. And that basically translates into the capacity to hire, to compensate, and even to remove people who work at the Export Promotion Agency, that it's very close to what the private sector is able to do. What does that mean? It basically means that we're able to have very, very specialized, highly trained people at that agency and at the Ministry of Foreign Trade that are able to work on high-paced, very dynamic, multicultural, multi-language environments. And those are, you know, world-class civil servants. You can find world-class civil servants in other institutions and other ministries in Costa Rica, for sure. But it's usually despite the system and not thanks to the system. And that's a big difference. So we have almost like a control group in the sense that you have an institution that works under different standards, and then you have the rest of the institutions that, like I mentioned, and I've worked in other institutions in government, and I found amazing, highly motivated, very capable individuals, but they do it despite the institutional design and despite the civil service. So I know, you know, working on issues around civil service and how, you know, people get hired and fired might not be the sexiest topic, but I think at the end of the day, organizational capability to implement is absolutely critical, because again, otherwise you end up having incredible academic research, all the evidence at your hands, but you're not able to translate that into concrete projects because they have to go through this very complex set of incentives, informal and formal rules and norms and power and individuals at the end of the day who are operating within those systems that are not being able to deliver upon.
Thank you so much for your time today, Andres. I've learned certainly a lot, and I think that was a really good note to end on, thinking about how academics might be able to shed light on actually getting things done, given that there's an increasing amount of evidence out there that shows the type of policies we should be aiming for.
So Oliver and Kartik, just I'm going to call out a couple of academics that are, or researchers that are doing interesting things on this end that might be, that I've learned a lot from. So two of them are Reda Sherif and Fuad Hasanov, who are working at the IMF. And they've been writing recently a lot of papers on institutional design for industrial policy. We didn't talk about industrial policy, but the point that at the end is the same one, is what are the institutions that you need to be able to deliver on complex policy and implementation of those. So they've been writing a lot of fascinating work on that. And then the other one is Amir Labdoui at Tide Center at Oxford. He has this fascinating metaphor, sports metaphor, about how we should approach these issues. He says it's not bowling, it's more like curling. The sport in bowling, you bowl, you throw the ball, and then the ball goes and you have no control over it. Whether curling, you actually launch it, and then there's a team of people who are making small adjustments as you go. And I think it perfectly illustrates this aspect of learning by doing that I think would be fascinating if more academics could spend time asking those questions around how institutions can learn, how institutions can adapt, and how institutions can work closely with the private sector to deliver upon this either, you know, policies or public goods or specific interventions that really drive development. So hope listeners can check the work of all those people, because I think they're writing some cutting edge things around this issue of organizational capabilities. And thank you very much for having me. This has been a pleasure, and best of luck with the podcast.
And this has been Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure that you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And all of our past episodes and future episodes are available on the VoxDev website.